Hello, everyone. My name is Rob Duboff, fortunate enough to be on the board of the Boston Book Festival. Hope you've had a good morning and are going to have a great afternoon, I'm sure, and this is going to be a great session. Just a couple of reminders. We want to keep these events free for everybody, and if you're able, it'd be great if you could donate some money to help us do that. There's a little place right in here in your program that tells you how you can do it right off your phone, so that would be very much appreciated. There will be a chance to ask some questions towards the end of this session, as in all our sessions. So with that, let me turn it over to Katie and get the session started.
Thank you so much. I feel like I'm with my people. We're spending a beautiful day inside this beautiful building talking about books. So I love you all already. We're going to have a great session. I'm super excited to be leading the way. My name is Katie Burke. I'm the chief people officer at a tech company called HubSpot. So when I walked in, everyone was like, what book did you write? And I was like, I just snuck in the back door and get to interview these two amazing, brilliant women. So I'm so delighted to be joined by Karen Dillon and Amy Edmondson to talk about their books. You might be thinking David's not here. That is because he was appointed as the first minister of Sierra Leone, which might be the best excuse ever for missing a panel. So just know that his book is available. It's incredible. I was lucky enough to read it and prep for it. So just want to make sure that that's represented. So Karen and Amy, I'm so excited to be with you. And I loved both of your books. I'm obviously a little biased. But I thought we could start a bit with a warm-up question. We're here at the Boston Book Festival celebrating all things books. What's a book that changed each of your lives? Karen, I'll start with you.
This is probably a trick answer, but it's true. A book I actually wrote. But it was a book with Clayton Christensen, who was a really well-regarded Harvard Business School professor. And I was then the editor of Harvard Business Review and met with him to create an article for HBR, which turned into a book called How Will You Measure Your Life? And that, for me, was Physician, Heal Thyself. It was a great opportunity for me to change my life. So that book, because of Clay, is the one I would answer.
It's incredible, changed a lot of people's lives, and you could see little tiny hints of it in your most recent book as well, so there are glimmers of it. Congrats on all the success. Amy, how about you?
Vital Lies, Simple Truths by Dan Goleman. Before anyone had heard of Dan Goleman, right before his emotional intelligence work, although it leads up to that work. And it actually is a book that got me to think about going to graduate school in the first place. And the premise was that we humans are very good at shielding ourselves from unwelcome information. That's the sort of the, you know, and vital lies, simple truths. And there are cognitive factors, there are interpersonal dynamics, and there are sort of organizational and societal factors that contribute to this ability to put the blinders on and miss really important data that would allow us to be more effective. So I couldn't believe, I'd never heard of any of this kind of research about cognition and group dynamics. It's like, wow, this is interesting. You know, I wonder if there's actually a career in that. Could there be?
That is so cool. Spark of genius. Amy, your book, which we'll get into shortly, is about intelligent failure. You two are both incredibly successful. What's something that you have failed at lately? And don't worry, I'll share mine. I have plenty. Amy, how about you?
But you said lately?
Yeah, lately.
Oh, gosh, that's not quite fair. I have lately failed to get enough sleep.
That's a good one. That's a
profound way, and I know better.
Karen's book can help you with that.
It will definitely
Karen, what's
make
something
really
you failed at lately?
Virtually every time I step in the kitchen, I fail at something. I am not a good cook. I'm the person who always wants to, what can I buy to bring to your party? So I think there are many people who can give testament to my failures in cooking.
I am also a horrific cook, and I would say, as it relates to all things inclusion, as you might imagine, a lot going on in the world at the moment. We have not nailed every interaction on making our employees feel safe and heard, and so I've gotten a lot of feedback this week. So there are a bunch of things that I'm not doing great at, and that's a good thing. That's okay. We're all growing and improving. Karen,
they're willing to tell you, then you're in good shape.
That's a really good, thank you for the reframe, Amy. That's very, very positive. Karen, your book focuses on micro-stress. What's one thing you do each week that de-stresses you?
So during the pandemic, my husband and I started doing a daily walk, which initially was because we live in an apartment and my kids were both home from college and we wanted a place to kind of air our concerns and fears. And it's turned into a really important thing we do every day, almost every day, unless there's some crazy schedule thing, we get out for a walk together. And I always feel like, you know, we come back and say we solved it, the problems of the world. But for me, having that communication with my husband while we're doing some exercise has been a really important micro-stress de-stressor.
That is so nice. Thanks for sharing. Amy, how about you?
I get out there and often go for a walk or sometimes for a run, and it's the same thing, but it's usually alone. And I think maybe as an introvert, I need that. I spend a lot of time with people at work and in sessions like this, and the alone time and being in motion during that alone time is very important.
I'm with you on the solo run, and people often ask if they can follow me on Strava. And I'm like, I don't have Strava. I don't use an Apple Watch. It's the only thing I don't measure. I don't think about. I'm usually rocking out to some terrible music and not measuring anything, which is kind of nice. Okay, let's jump into both of your books. Amy, growing up, so many of us were taught to avoid failure at all costs. And your book suggests we've been wrong about failure all along. What have we been wrong about, and how should we as a group think about failure differently?
I suppose the best place to start is that we've been wrong about the idea that failure is a kind of single concept. Failure, the word failure covers a lot of territory. And indeed, there are failures that we should work hard to avoid and to teach our kids how to avoid. I mean, to be you know, like simple about it, you don't let your kids chase the little kids, you know, chase the ball into the street where there's traffic, right? You sort of, that's a failure you would want to avoid at all costs. And you don't intervene and do their math homework for them because you don't want them to struggle with the solving of the problem. That's a failure experience they need to have to sort of to grow and learn. So the main idea in the book is there are three kinds of failure. Only one is good. We should have more of them. We tend to be failure averse, risk averse. So we avoid the good kind, which I call intelligent failures, which is where progress is. It's also where adventure is. And often, by the way, new friendships lie. So we gotta learn to embrace, and I think it's easier to embrace the good kind when you have the cognitive distinction that helps us separate the good kind from the not so good and preventable kind.
That's so true and such an important reminder. I distinctly remember I had a volleyball game in high school and I shanked the pass that caused us to lose the game, right?
Yeah.
And I got home and I remember saying to my mom, like, this is the worst day of my life. And she said, you can either be in the arena or outside the arena, but if you're in the arena, stuff like this is going to happen. She was basically like, you can quit and never go back. But just so you know, this is kind of the cost and price, and it stuck with me forever because I was so down, and she was sort of like, I'm going to make you feel better a little bit, but I'm not going to solve this for you because if you're going to go back out, you're going to lose more games, and I think it's an important reminder. Okay, Karen, we talk a lot about stress with a big S, capital S, as a culture, but we rarely talk about micro-stress. What makes micro-stress different, and how should we collectively think about it?
So microstress is a word that my co-author Rob Cross and I came up with to describe something we were seeing in deep dive interviews with high performers, but they didn't have the language for, and we didn't have the language for. It's basically, we know big stress, things people have empathy for you, death in the family, loss of a job, serious health issue. We know how to talk about that. We know how to support other people. Microstress are things that happen in your everyday life, the interactions with other people that are so routine and so brief that your brain barely registers them, but your body will. And so over a day, a week, a month, we will have dozens and dozens of microstress in interaction with people we're close to, personally and professionally, that we almost can't remember. The phenomenon I would describe is if any of you have ever fallen into bed at the end of the night, and you don't even remember why you're so tired. You know, you didn't run a marathon that day, but you're fried. That's probably a result of a battering of microstress in the day. So just a simple example would be a serious health issue is stress. The moment you realize your schedule's too hectic and you can't meet your friends for tennis and you're worried about am I gonna start getting out of shape because I have to call them and tell them, are they gonna start not including me? That's a microstress. You know, no one dies from microstress, but they add up to something really significant.
It resonated from our employees' perspective. The microstress you cited feels so relevant to so many of their lives, including mine. One of the concepts that we talk about, I felt targeted by your book at times in the best way possible, but I like that it provides some really thoughtful solutions. But one of the things we talk about is the Buddhist concept of a second arrow, that what happens to you is not as bad as then the story you tell yourself, to your point on the tennis, now my friends aren't going to include me anymore, that sort of thing. And so the things that we've introduced in team meetings is when people share, I'm feeling stressed because I miss my tennis lesson, I'm like, is this a first arrow or a second arrow problem?
Right.
And it allows people a little bit to go, what's the microstress influence? So we're going to start using your terminology in our meetings more often to help distinguish the two. So thank you. Amy, one of my favorite examples of failure in your book is about Toyota, all things Toyota, and the famous cord that sometimes actually gets a little misunderstood. Oh, help me understand why it's such a great example of intelligent failure.
Well, it's a great example of preventing basic failure.
Yes.
And preventing complex failure as well. But so the end-on cord, for those of you who don't know, is a literal cord above the assembly line in a Toyota production facility. And frontline workers, team members, are asked to pull that cord, not if they see a problem, but if they even think there might be a problem, right? So a potential problem, an ambiguous threat, is fair game. In fact, what most people don't know is that for every, and then it also, many people think, okay, you pull the cord, the line stops, which is a very big deal in an automotive. The line is stopped for 1 minute. That would be a loss of $4,000 or $5,000 to the bottom line at Toyota. So they don't. The line, it turns out that for every 11 pulls of the end-on cord, the line stops once, and here's why. When you pull the cord, that doesn't stop the line. It's only when you pull it the second time it stops the line. When you pull the cord, a team leader comes by and says, "What's up?" And you say, "I'm just not quite sure this is perfect." The team leader says, "Ooh, let's look at it together." Usually within the cycle time, about less than a minute, 57 seconds, they will, 11 times out of 10, they'll sort out that it's actually fine. But the 12th time, yep, there was a problem there. And then the line will stop until we fix it. We don't want to send anything bad down the line. So it's, you can see how it's preventing, but it's what I think the magic of this culturally is that you don't punish the false alarms. In fact, you reward the false alarms. There's a deep appreciation. Thank you so much for calling, right? Thanks for pulling me over here so we could take a look at this, you know, potential problem together, because this is how we, you know, get better and produce high quality cars. So it's building in speaking up, it's building in prevention, it's building in a sort of aspirational level of quality, and it's not intelligent failure. Intelligent failure is in new territory. There's nothing new about an automotive assembly line. Yep. That is familiar territory.
I loved it, and I have to say I read it twice for that exact reason, because my understanding was like so many other people, where you pull the cord, the line stops. The fact that it is building in the psych safety to be able to speak up to your manager to say there might be a problem, that their first reaction is, "What's up? Let's figure this out together." And then that it's built into the process, I thought was super thoughtful. Yeah. So I learned something. I had to reread it twice to make sure I got it right. So thank you for that.
Think about, like, what are the end-on cords, you know, at HubSpot? What are the end-on cords in your family, in your team, in your organization? You know, what are the ways in which we make it easy for people to speak up when they're not quite sure?
I love that.
That's a great example to think about the parallel.
Yeah.
What are your end-on cords?
Absolutely. I will be doing that. You mentioned family, which is the perfect segue to Karen's book. Many micro-stresses are related to family dynamics, couple dynamics, difficult coworkers. None of us in this room have any difficult relationships like that whatsoever. They're all just completely nurturing and healthy and wonderful. But just in case we did, just in the very hypothetical instance that we did, what's the best way to navigate micro-stress created by tough relationships?
So in our research, and then some serious additional research we've done, where almost 12,000 people have ranked their micro-stress as a rater of the micro-stress, negative or draining interactions with family and friends is the number one across all groups. And it's not surprising, right? Because the people we love most know how to push our buttons. And there's also something that happens in the brain that's really interesting. Mm. Your brain is always trying to predict interactions with people, but it also remembers. Mm. So the stranger who annoys you will not annoy you as much as your husband or your daughter who's done that 20 times before, and your brain's predicting that annoyance will come from this. So we're kind of, I liken it to by the time you get home from work and you've had all the micro-stresses there, your teacup's totally full and the family micro-stresses add to it and it spills over. So the reality is, for most of us, that people we're closest to are the ones that cause us the most micro-stress. But the key is, it's not the person, it's not that they're toxic relationships. We love these people. They're intense relationships and close relationships, but we love them. What we can look to shift is the interaction with people. So it's not necessarily, you don't have to drop people from your life, but you can try to have a more constructive interaction with people. I'll just give you a simple example from my own life. My daughter is a college senior, and I worry about her all the time, and I always have lots of ideas for things she should be thinking about doing, which I tend to text to her the moment I think about it. And then I have realized through working on this book that I probably pepper her with microstructures in a chemistry class, and here comes a suggestion from me, did you get the car inspected? Or I'm thinking about things, so I'm creating microstress for her, and she'll do it back to me. So we've tried to be more constructive, where I try to maybe call her, and we have a conversation, and she can pick up if it's convenient for her or not. Or I appreciate her every now and then spontaneously texting me, so I know she's okay. We've tried to shift the interaction with the same amount of love, but finding ways that we're not creating microstress for the people that we're closest to.
I love that you used an example where you were the person creating
the perpetrator.
I think that says a lot about you as both a parent and a person. I think that's cool. I also love that you talked about setting a time limit around those interactions with people. I thought that was a good example of, like, for a big family event, saying, okay, great, we're going to stay for an hour, and keeping it simple. So thank you for sharing that. Amy, let's talk about something that I care deeply about, a very famous failure that I didn't know about, champagne. And so I'd love to hear and understand how... the producer of some of the most successful champagne in the world was actually a direct result of a failure. Can you tell us about it?
Well, it's actually many failures. So it's and talk about books. It's just a wonderful book, a biography of Barbe Nicole Ponsardin-Clicquot, who tragically lost her beloved husband at the age of 27. They were both 27. And Well, she was born in 1777 in the Champagne region of France, and she and François had a dream to build a wine business, to build a champagne business. But the first few years, and before he died of the flu or something, were really struggling. And then the struggles, and she decided, I mean, instead of doing what everybody expected her to do and sort of retire to the countryside and be with her children and so forth, she said, no, I'm going to keep going, and which was quite remarkable in its own right. But the next, let's say, 10 years were nonstop failures, really. You know, 1 year the crops don't work or aren't good. 1 year all of the inventory is sort of explodes in a hull of a ship. You know, 1 year a war starts that essentially makes exporting and distribution impossible. And there was a very real challenge. The wine then was quite cloudy and not the crystal clear wine that we know today as champagne. And she invented a sort of a rack that allowed all the yeast to get to the bottom of the neck of the bottle and come out easily. It was a very simple, mechanical invention. But that solved one real technical problem. But she kept taking bold risks to explore markets in different countries. Ultimately, found a very receptive audience in Russia and elsewhere. And the widow Clicquot, the Veuve Clicquot, became one of the most successful brands in history.
So now when you're drinking fine champagne, you can just remind yourself you're not only supporting great women, entrepreneurs, you're also supporting failure. So I think it's a good tradition. We tend to use champagne to celebrate successes, but as a result of your book, I see two reasons to toast failure as well. So I'm going to use it as an excuse to invest in a nice bottle of champagne at some point. Karen, one thing that really stuck with me about your book was that high performers build resilience as a muscle. Why is resilience so important in balance, and what did you see about how they actually do that?
Well, a lot of people don't build resilience as a muscle, and I actually think that is one of the most underdeveloped skills in children, and people who are very successful go through life without failures. That's why it's so important. And so when they have something that comes in their 20s or their 30s, it can completely derail them. It's too late. Exactly. It's too late. They don't know how to recover from failure. So building resilience becomes really important to navigating the challenges that we'll all have in our life. What we found in our research was, short version, is resilience can be a team sport. Resilience doesn't need to rely on you finding some great internal grit because you're stronger. What doesn't kill you makes you stronger. You don't have to be resilient that way. You can, but you can also build what we call a resilience network, just people that you can turn to for different forms of help. They don't all have to be ride or die friends, but besties. It could be a mentor who helps you see things in a different perspective when you have a setback. It could be a colleague who kind of puts the political situation at work into context for you. Mm. It could be the friends that make you laugh. I mean, those things are all really important. So the people who are the high performers who were not derailed by microstress in our research were people who successfully built a resilience network and thought of it actively. They thought of different relationships that would help them, and they could be, in return, helpful to other people in being resilient through difficult times.
I love that. We have a program at HubSpot called Rethinking Resilience, and we partially use it to train our managers on just building resilience tools into their day-to-day toolkit, because as you might imagine, if you got appointed a manager, you probably did something right to get there, and your first time when you have a setback, it feels like you're the worst person and manager HubSpot's ever hired. And what we find is building some of those rituals in, so like gratitude at the end of the week, or spending time like laughing and actually having fun with people, and or sharing failures, all can be those. So thanks for sharing that. Amy, one of the biggest points in your book is that not all failures are created equal. You alluded to this earlier. What do great teams and organizations know about failing smartly and learning from them?
Well, the right kind of wrong, title of the book, are intelligent failures. And intelligent failures are novel forays into new territory that didn't produce the result you wanted. And so there are essentially four criteria that distinguish a good failure from a not-so-good failure. And they are, in fact, the same criteria that you would think through to design the right kinds of experiments or risks. So new territory, right? If you can look up the answer on the internet, please do. Right? We don't need to reinvent the wheel, as it
yes.
were. They are in pursuit of a goal, not just random action to sort of see what happens, but you have a, you're trying to make progress towards something mm-hmm. in your life, in your work, in your company. They are informed by available knowledge. In other words, you've done your homework. You have looked around, you've talked to people to figure out, what do we know about this? What might work? You have a good reason to believe what you're about to do might work. And finally, it's as small as possible, right? No bigger than it has to be to get the knowledge that we today lack that we hope to have after this experiment. So those are the criteria, and those are essentially design elements of a good experiment, right? Is it genuinely new? Is there some reason this will get us closer to our ultimate goal? Have we prepared and thought through what might work? You know, are we minimizing the risk to our time and resources? And if we are doing all of that well and it still fails, we should celebrate, right? Because we just got new knowledge that we sorely needed to make the progress.
I love that. And I love the sharing the learning with the rest of the organization. I think that part is the part that
we often miss.
That I think even as I read the book, I was like, we used to be better at that. And I think as you scale and get bigger, it's hard to scale, right?
It is. And I like to say that, you know, the fifth criterion or maybe a half criterion is that you learn from it, of course, but also that you tell everyone you know.
Yep.
Meaning, you know, in the organization, somehow systematically, that knowledge needs to be made available because someone else in your company repeating the same experiment and failing the second time, that no longer qualifies as intelligent.
We had an intern, so we have something at HubSpot called the Failure Forum, and people get up and share things that did not go well. And we had an intern who shipped a bunch of code that took down our software. This was, you know, 10 years ago. Please don't tweet this. But one of the things he stood up and shared was he basically said, I'm the reason we've added some friction into the process. So when you get mad about the friction, just know that it was a direct result of before I failed. And he said, it felt terrible. So when I get annoyed about how many screens you have to go through or how many checks it get, I'm reminded of my own failure. And it built a bunch of empathy from our engineers who, as you might imagine, were like, this is so annoying. I have to jump through these hoops.
But now we know why.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I appreciate him for that. Speaking of failure, I have to know, did you know the title of your book before you started writing, given that you
knew? Yes.
Yes. It's that good of a title.
I did not want to propose to write this book until I knew its title.
It totally fits. I had a feeling. Okay, Karen, you talk about purpose multipliers, and I actually think that goes back to meaning, which is clearly such a big part of your life's purpose. I circled it multiple times when I was reading your book and underlined it. Can you tell us a little bit about what purpose multipliers are and why they matter so much in combating microstress? Mm.
So they matter in every way, but they definitely matter in combating microstress. And when we think about purpose, most of us think of something really big and lofty, right? Cure cancer, raise $1 million for charity. And in reality, if that's the only way we think about those things, those are fabulous, but most of us are never going to do that. thus does that mean we don't have purpose? So what we recommend from our research from MicroStress is that we look for purpose in everyday moments, and it's really possible to find it in an authentic connection with another person, in just a small moment of somehow being the person you want to be in connecting with another person. But it's hard to be conscious of doing that, so we recommend that you do what we call purpose multipliers, where you are having that moment of purpose that's also providing you with something else. So when I talked about my husband and I doing the daily walks, that's physical activity that's really important to us, plus a really important moment of connecting on our days. Finding ways that you can feel purpose in small moments that will also bring you and the other person benefits. Maybe you're really interested in a community cause or a political group. It's not just advancing that from your perspective, but making authentic connections with other people that will in turn kind of put your life in perspective. It's really hard to be absorbed and completely ground down by the microstress of life when you talk to people who have different life experiences and you're reminded of, in the grand scheme of things, your problems are not so big. Those small moments of authentic connection that help bring you other purposes in your everyday life can play a really important role in tamping down the effect of microstress.
I love that. I have my best friend and her husband have a mission statement for their family, and it helps them make decisions. It's partially like they hit their goals and they decide whether or not to do things based on that. And I remember hearing it and being like, come on, you two, that's enough. But truly, it does help dictate what falls in their yes bucket and their no bucket. And I think if you think about how busy everyone is, having that sort of mission to come back to, whether as an individual or a couple, is really meaningful.
There's one of the people in our research that really stands out. The subset of people in our research that we thought dealt with microstress really well, even though they were all high performers, we started calling the 10%ers. It was roughly 10% of our research group. And there was a guy who journaled every Sunday night because he had six roles in his life that were really important to him, and he decided it with his wife. It was everything from being a good husband and father, but being a good community member, et cetera. And he kind of held himself accountable on a weekly basis.
Wow.
And it sounded like a lot, but he'd kept on track for 20 years and lived a really rich life, a really professional, success professionally. But he was on track with what mattered to him, the purposes that mattered to him.
I love that story. I thought it was really meaningful. It stuck with me in the book. And I liked that it felt very manageable to do on a weekly basis if you built it into part of your routine. So thanks for sharing that. An overlapping theme of both of your books is rethinking fundamental wisdom. What's one piece of conventional wisdom you wish we'd all forget after reading your books? Karen, maybe I'll start with you.
I don't think it's a great thing to do things like yoga and mindfulness and gratitude. I think those things are all good. But I feel like those things are all about making you stronger to deal with more and more stress. You know, how can I be stronger to endure this? I think it would be great to think about what's a higher leverage opportunity to remove some of the stress from my life. So not just targeting being stronger, but like actively removing some of the micro stress in your life. I think that would be a really important thing. And I've tried to do that too.
I like that.
Yeah. I think I'm not sure how to put this into the right words, but I think there is a sort of conventional wisdom about, you know, if you want to, here's the words, if you want to do something, do it right. Right? It's like, and parents have said that for millennia, right? You know, do it right. Like, just don't do it. And what they mean is don't be sloppy, don't mail it in. But it sinks in and leads us to that message that, you know, I only want to do safe bets, right? I only want to do things that I know I can get it right. And then that deprives us of all sorts of adventure, achievement, and even joy.
It's kind of what your mom was saying to you, right? It's sort of, if you're going to do this, it's messy. You have to be okay with failure. That's part of being part of it, the experience of being part of it.
And I think it gives you such empathy for people who are just starting out. So we have a woman on my team who we were interviewing, doing the chats before she joined HubSpot. And I said, so tell me about, you know, what you're passionate about outside of work. And she said, I'm actually learning to play the fiddle, and I'm going to give a concert on my 50th birthday. And I was like, are you good? And she's like, I'm horrendous. You have no idea. But
love
one of the things she said was, she was like, she's a runner too. Of course, she's good at everything. But she said, I'm good at running. I've always been good at running. I haven't taken up something that's really hard for me to learn in a really long time. And part of what I want to model to my kids is that it's okay to take up something new.
And be bad at it.
She's like, they listen to me every night. And she's like, it is so painful. It is gutturally painful. But she's like, part of the reason why I picked a goal for 6 years out is I have time to keep iterating on it. And I think sometimes, I know for me, I forget what it's like to be new at a tech company and to not know anyone, not even know how to turn on your computer and to ask for help. And so I think in addition to helping you find greater hobbies or activities. I also think it helps you put yourself in the shoes of other people, because yes. if you've been doing something for so long, you can miss that.
Builds empathy.
Yes.
And can I give you an organizational one?
Please.
So please, let's wipe this out of your organizational vocabulary. Don't come to me with problems.
Come to me with solutions.
That's a great one.
Yeah. Right? Now, what that is, you know, I think the intention is do your thinking, you know, be creative. But the message that is heard is, what? Don't come to me with problems, right?
I think that's a great example.
Just don't speak up, right? And I like to say, kind of building on something Karen said earlier, that we are good problem detectors, we human beings. But problem solving is almost always a team sport organizations, right? Because there's a contribution from that department over there, and there's a contribution from that department over there. And so thank you for bringing us that problem. Now, how can we help? What should we try?
I love that. Fair warning, we have about 15 minutes, and then we're going to get to all of your questions, so just be prepared. I'm not going to do all the hard work here. We're going to turn it over to the room, so just sharing, because I know some of my processors like a little advanced warning. So, Amy, I have a question for you about when you come into an organization, what are some signs that they have a healthy failure culture?
Lots of bad news, right? Lots of requests for help, lots of questions and what ifs, and a good sort of healthy sense of humor around the things that go wrong.
I think so you're saying, I think what I like is everyone probably when you come in particularly is like, there's nothing to see here, everything's perfect,
right.
An HBS professor, an esteemed author, you would like it if people are like, here are four messes that we're trying
right.
to solve.
Yep.
Okay, I like that.
And they've got a smile on their face.
I love that. Karen, let's talk about trust for a second as a micro-stress. Lack of trust was a pretty big micro-stress, and you had some really strong examples in the book of how it can compound, as so many micro-stresses do. Why is trust such a big lever for micro-stress, and how can we think about, if you have a relationship with whom, I know for sure, particularly at work, this can be hard, how to rebuild that trust given the implications it can cause down the line?
So you phrased that. Well, it's lack of trust, not necessarily distrust or mistrust. And it's just the reality of how we work now. We work with new groups and new teams, and people come and go. And it used to be, in the old days, you would work with people for 10 or 15 years, and you knew what you could count on them to do. They knew you well. You had a kind of shorthand for things. And most of us just don't have that now because of the way we work. So not having that is a micro-stress, because I don't know if I can count on you to deliver to deliver it on time. I don't know if you're going to actually, you know, finish it up on Friday, or you're going to leave it for me to finish. Or I don't know if when you give me criticism, it's you've really thought about it and you're trying to be constructive. We don't have that yet. So the lack of trust in everyday interactions with colleagues is just a kind of constant micro-stress. So building trust and finding ways to build trust is really important to reducing that. But it's not like they're suddenly going to be, you know, we're not going to go do trust falls and no, I deeply love you, man. That's not realistic. You can't do that. But you can find ways to build trust in small moments with colleagues and back and forth by demonstrating your competence and showing the things that you can be relied on to do and using past experiences to sort of inform conversations. We have to be a little more conscious that we don't have that trust with everybody yet. And then that is an important thing to reduce in your everyday work stress.
I really liked that reminder, because I think, to your point, distrust can be a stressor, but the lack of trust in the new person example is such a powerful example.
Yeah.
So thank you for that push and reframe. It's a good one. Amy, what do the best leaders know about intelligent failure? When you see a leader where you're like, this person's got it figured out, what do they know about failure?
Well, they know it's something you want, right? They understand the relationship between intelligent failure and innovation, which is to say the relationship between intelligent failure and tomorrow's revenues as opposed to today's, right? That if we, I mean, everything can look great, be going great, be buttoned down, and we're performing well, and we're not seeing the future where this formula will eventually become obsolete. So they just understand that we need it, we want it. A healthy, you know, a healthy organization is one that has some solid portion of things that are being tried that don't work along the way to discovering new things that do work.
Can I ask a question? Who's doing it well? Who do you see in your book?
Well, you know, it's in most organizations, there are pockets of doing it well as opposed to, okay, just, you know.
Amazon, perfect, or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, Amazon is a pretty good example. They are very aggressively good at experimenting.
Right.
Trying things and cutting them short when they, you know, stopping them when they're not working. I love to talk about Pixar. That's an organization that does it very well. By the time they release a product, it will succeed, but only because they've been relentless on finding its faults before we get to the release.
Right.
I also think so much is in the storytelling about leaders. We have such a tendency to build up all the success and all the hype and share that.
Yep.
And one of the things, so at our big event this year, we had, don't hate me, I know the Red Sox panel is after this. We had Derek Jeter at our conference. He's actually quite a lovely human. I know, exactly, deserved. But it's funny, he talks about, he's like, you know, my career is told as such this success story. And his first year in AA, he set a record for number of strikeouts. He said he spent $400 a week, which, as you might imagine, a lot of money on a payphone, calling his parents. And he was like, I was bawling, crying. So he's like, I was a total failure on the field. I was a total failure off the field. I missed my parents. I missed home. And he's like, I almost just walked away from it. And he's like, very few people tell that. When you think about the legend of Derek Jeter, and now, of course, the Red Sox fan, you can say he started out slow when you retell it. But I love that he's courageous enough to share that because I do think otherwise everyone says overnight success or a storied career, and you miss those moments that are actually the most interesting to learn from.
Absolutely. And Ed Catmull at Pixar, who co-founder and then longtime CEO, would constantly say, you know, I've got to talk about my mistakes first or other people won't do it, right? You have to really model the behavior. You have to invite the behavior. You have to reward the behavior.
I love that. That's a great example. Karen, value setting exercise. We talked about, like, purpose is so critical to what you do. Help us understand how you can think about your own value as a leader and why that might matter to people.
Well, first of all, most of us will talk about what we did on our vacation more than we will spend more time than we'll spend talking about what we value, even as leaders sometimes. And I think if you don't articulate that personally for yourself and as a leader, nobody has a compass, you know, right? How are we going to make the right decisions that are aligned with our values? So I think it becomes really important to you personally, and it becomes to your organization to know and articulate the values and why. Why are these our values, right? You know, I worked with someone once who said, do good things, don't do bad things. Like, okay, I could, that's sort of easy, black and white. But having a value, we value learning, or we value failure, or we value growth, or we value the opportunity to challenge each other. I think that's really important to articulate. Otherwise, you're never going to, again, you don't know how you're steering it. And how will you measure success? Yeah, exactly. And why will you take risks?
Yeah. What's something you value as a leader?
I personally value collaboration. I love collaborating, and I think there's something in the book we talk about is called co-creation, but it's a purpose generator for a lot of people, and it is for me personally. When you're kind of building and scaffolding your ideas off of other people, and together you've done something, you probably, hopefully, all had it with colleagues, where you created something with colleagues that you felt really proud of, but it was the experience as much as the outcome. Mm-hmm. So personally, I really value collaboration, and I think that brings out better performance in me and the colleagues. That's how I like to work.
And Amy, what's something you value as a leader?
Vulnerability, honesty.
I like that. The other thing I've learned is I used to wait for people to ask, and then I would tell them, and now we have Working With Me docs, which just makes it easier, where you're like, you don't have to guess. It's just much easier to know.
What is that, Working With Me docs? Is it some kind of like a brief about yourself? This is who I am, and this is how I work?
Yes.
Oh, that's
and
great.
The how I work is helpful because it often, so as an example, one of my values is a bias for action, but I clarify in that does not mean action at the expense of thoughtful consideration. It also does not mean action at all times. That does not mean not taking rest.
Right.
So as an example, I set expectations around turnaround time for communication. If I send you an email, get back to me whenever you can. If I send you a text message, I really try not to do that, so it means it's pretty urgent.
Right.
But those expectations, especially for someone who's new to our team and trying to build trust, mean that they spend less time trying to guess what I want and more time actually doing it. And actually, Claire Hughes-Johnson, who's the CEO of a company called Stripe, she's the person who pushed us all to do that and has been instrumental in doing it. And she adds things that stress me out.
Right.
These things cause me stress. I do this when I'm stressed. Yeah. If I'm talking fast, as an example, I talk fast all the time, but I talk faster when I'm stressed. That's an indication. It is okay for you to slow me down or to say, I'm reading
Not
stress
tracking.
In you and here's what's going on. I think that giving the people that permission is super helpful.
I think that's great. Do you write your own? I'm scared. This fascinating exercise. How does it get done?
I write my own, but then when you write your own, you put in a slightly desirable version of yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
So the best feedback I get on it is from my EA.
Okay.
She literally is like, no, This is nonsense. Yeah. Cut this out on stuff. And I leave my team's edits in there. So as an example, it says per Karen, per Amy.
Right.
And I think that's helpful for people to see sometimes. So yeah, I find it very helpful. Yeah. And it's available. Claire shares the Google template online. So if anyone's interested in doing it. Yeah. It is now time for audience questions. What I'm going to do to give you two more seconds is to just ask, we have some aspiring writers in the room. Do you have any tips, given that you're both such successful multiple-time authors, on writing and editing?
Well, the writing is editing, right? True. So it's do not be afraid. I'm very afraid of the blank screen, but try not to be afraid of the blank screen or the blank page. Just get bad writing out there.
I like that.
As fast as you can. You know, get it out there. Sit down and do it. And then guess what? You get to make it better.
That's a good one. I like
every time I sit down at the evolving draft of any chapter, unfortunately, I'm always starting, you know, there's the beginning again, and it's just not good enough, right? So I make it better. So if you notice that sometimes the beginnings of chapters are better, then
I love
that's
that.
Why.
I think that's great advice. Karen, what about you?
I would like to say follow your energy. I think it's really hard to write when you don't feel like writing or you don't feel like writing that chapter. Go to another chapter. I personally can't write unless I feel like
or do a different
chapter. The thing you want to do. Yeah, right. I think we kind of know.
Exactly.
Whatever it is that our energy is, I think that's a really good way to do it. I can't write when I don't feel like writing. It's just that simple. So when I allow myself permission to follow my energy, then I do much better writing, I think.
I really like that. Thanks for sharing. Okay, questions from all of you. Julia. Oh,
there is
like,
a
go up to the mic. Sorry.
Amplification opportunity.
Hello. Thank you all for your comments and the work and the books. My question is, what failure, either personal or professional, are you most proud of in your life and why? Thank you.
Amy, you want to take
well, that? Sure. In a way, because that's the nature of that question makes it a very small number, but the failure I'm most proud of was the failure to find support for the hypothesis in my first research project in graduate school. Mm-hmm. I was dead wrong. It was 180, or at least the data seemed to suggest I was dead wrong. And without telling the whole long story in detail, I opened the book with it. The reason I was wrong, the wrongness of it, led me to somewhere so much more interesting and literally allowed me to discover the notion of psychological safety, how it varies across groups and companies, how it matters for learning, how it matters for performance, and then led to, you know, a very robust research literature that I and others have contributed to that I think has had a positive impact on practice. Could not have happened without my being so desperately wrong at the outset.
I love that one. Karen, how about you?
I think I was once asked by an editor of one of my previous books she gave me an idea she wanted me to write a book on, and I struggled with it, but she had asked me to, you know, an editor I knew would get published. I spent about a year thinking about how to write and could I tried to talk myself into it. And then eventually I like, I'm not passionate about that. And I'm not passionate about it. I'm not going to write a good book. And so the failure to respond to her request, I guess, or to come up with a book. But I think it was absolutely, it's following my energy. My energy, it took a year to come up with the no, should have been telling me that there was no easy yes.
Mine, which Julia is very familiar with, is so I was our first female C-level executive at HubSpot. Now I'm very fortunate we have four more. But at the time, I felt like my job was to be everything to everyone, so I said yes to everything. I completely burned myself out. I was a shell of myself that first year, and so my biggest failure was completely not setting priorities and feeling like I had the world on my shoulders. And one of the reasons it's my favorite failure is now I'm a huge proponent of women setting more boundaries in the workplace, and sharing that I think hopefully normalizes people who are the first in their role in any way, shape, or form to do that, and to encourage different reframing on how they start.
Someone in our research that I thought had such a good rule of thumb, one of the high performers who dealt with stress well, said he just got comfortable with saying respectful no's so that he had more time and energy for spontaneous yeses. But it's okay to say no, as they say, no is a full sentence, but you can do it respectfully. But yeah, not having to say yes to everything. Yeah,
you're not respecting yourself if you say yes to everything.
Yeah, I agree.
I think that's right. Do you want to use the microphone? Sorry, I don't want to get in trouble. Hi.
Thank you again for being here. Wow, this is tall. And
we can hear you,
you
fine.
You can bend it down a little bit.
There you go. Nailed it.
Very, very 5'4". As someone who was in the corporate world 25 years, leading this the old way at when I led employer branding at SAS and PR at Unilever, the old way to develop trust was get to know the whole person. Get to know the person outside of work. Spend time with your teammates, not trust falls, but like take a cooking class together. Especially it was incumbent upon the women to do that. But now with this new world we live in, we're not all together. Everyone doesn't work at one particular campus. And Amy, when you were talking about Toyota, everyone is there pulling the cord. But now I'm interested in how onboarding has changed. How do you infuse automatic trust and confidence for new employees who come in and they have to feel empowered and to be able to pull the cord or ask the question or be suspicious without retribution or, you know, scorn?
That's a great and important question.
Thank you.
Well, I think you have to get out ahead of it with very clear and compelling statements. I think of two things. I mean, the values, the mission, et cetera, being clear about what they are so we know what's expected. But even more granularly, to be clear about the nature of this work or this project, right? If this is, I don't know, if it's software, well, we want to catch the bugs, right? I mean, if it's aviation, we want safe flights. It's like being very clear about the nature of the work, the reality that things will go wrong. The only question is, will we hear about them fast enough to kind of work together to fix them, right? So explaining why it matters and letting everyone know that you know this thing doesn't just roll along merrily along, right? It's not how it works. It goes in fits and starts and problems and opportunities, and just get out ahead of this is what we do, this is how we work, and when in doubt, you know, speak up and let us know. If you're struggling, if you're going to be late with something, let us know. Mm-hmm. And then proactively asking good questions, the kinds of questions that give people room to respond and are targeted at the issues at hand. You know, what are you seeing out there? What are you concerned about? What opportunities are there? Walk me through your thinking on that. Those kinds of questions.
Good questions. What about you, Karen?
I would just add, as a manager for years, that I would always say to people that were new employees that were reporting to me, the first 6 months we're going to learn about each other. So this is your chance to ask questions. I'm going to give you feedback that may feel constructive, but criticism, because if you're learning how to do things, this is the time to do it. You kind of make it part of the culture. And so the expectation is for 6 months, we're going to be doing back and forth and pushing and checking with each other. Good. I think that's safe.
That's a good frame
for them to
right?
do it. And then the other thing I'd say about Zoom world now is we so quickly go into the meetings, or people are multitasking until the meeting starts. You know, even just taking, maybe you're not going to do a cooking class together, but just take, how was your weekend? Mm-hmm. You know, 2 minutes in the conversation like that, connecting with each other as human beings, however briefly, I think is really important. And then one of the things I heard from someone in our research, during the pandemic, she started doing walking meetings with the people who reported to her, where she'd be on her phone, they'd be on her phone, and she said, you can't be at a desk and you can't have any note-takings. We just want to talk. We'll remember the important things. But it's a little bit of a moment of connection in a different way, too, rather than the temptation of being involved on other things.
And some steps, too.
Yeah, exactly. Purpose multiplier.
I do also think there's a component of the framing of it. So one of the things I find, we're a hybrid company, and people will often say it was so much better when we could sit next to each other in the same room. And one of the things we hear from a lot of underrepresented groups, parents, BIPOC leaders, is that the old days, you know, the golf course wasn't necessarily as inclusive as we might have hoped to begin with.
Totally agree with that.
So when people say it was so much better, what I always say is there may have been parts of it that felt better for you or for others. I certainly feel that way. But also, we have a huge opportunity to build a more inclusive workforce by being willing to flex on our approach here. And so we start a good chunk of our team meetings at a leadership level by doing your name, how you're feeling, and the only rules are you can't say good or busy, because everyone says good or busy. And then the third thing is who we ask for help when you need it. And as you might imagine, when people get on board, they're like, this is the cheesiest meeting I've ever been. I don't want to work in HR at HubSpot. But the reason we do it is because when someone does need help, you find out very quickly because you can feel it in their voice. And having someone check in on you after the meeting just on a one-on-one basis makes a big difference. So those little things, I would say, add up.
I want to add something because one of my colleagues is in the room and he taught me something that is just, it's been revelatory to me. That's Rob Lackenauer. He's the managing partner of the firm I work with now. We do something called appreciation. So at the end of an important offsite, not just every day, we have an activity where you have to go. I have to say an appreciation of one other person, and it's simple. All you can say is thank you. You can't have a long, oh, it was lots of people, glad that was helpful to say thank you. And then you need to turn to the next person and offer an appreciation. And it can be, Rob, I appreciate so much what an amazing leader you are for our organization. And all he would say is thank you. And then he would turn to someone else. And almost inevitably by the end of it, there's tears. Like people, just the moments of humanity that you have with one another to say, I appreciate your candor in sharing a question that maybe we were afraid to ask. And then thank you. And it's really That's revelatory. Powerful. I love this. I love this activity. I think it's a highlight of our current organization.
I love that. Thanks for sharing. And a VIP guest in the room. Sir, we kept you waiting. I'm so sorry.
Hi. Thank you for this discussion. Building on this concept that you work together and collaborate and you have the pull cord at Toyota, how do you build in conflict resolution or difference resolution that really everybody shares in and people are not stressed about? Or else, if you're too stressed, you have to leave the organization or you get fired.
Great question.
Well, there's a very serious it depends, right? It depends on the nature of the conflict here. I believe that in an uncertain world, that's the one we're in, your success depends on high-quality bets. And high-quality bets depend on high-quality conversations. And those are ones where there almost always is conflicting points of view that came together, right? So in those, but if it's, you know, if we're making a decision about whether to launch a product or whether to hire this executive, we should not only expect, we should welcome conflicting views and we should walk down the ladder of inference to figure out, you know, what do we really know? What do we not know? How might we learn more before we make some, you know, really big decision? Now, if you're talking about sort of conflicts, personal conflicts unrelated to the substance of the work, that's a different answer. And sometimes you will need a mediator to kind of work through, like, what's really going on here. So, the type of conflict, the size of conflict, the relationship of the conflict to our execution on our mission. But there's plenty of you know, really good practices, and probably what they have in common is being quite deliberate, quite thoughtful, slow it down, understand it better so that we can resolve it better.
I'll just offer a different perspective also from one of my colleagues, is that too often we're so afraid of conflict that we have too little conflict.
We don't deal with it
at
all.
So too much conflict is can be negative and can be destructive, but so can too little conflict. So finding a healthy amount of conflict and making that a part of the organization's value, or in your personal life, making part of the value is really important. So too little is what a lot of us veer towards, but getting a little bit more toward the center is really constructive. It's the interaction that can make a difference, right? Come off, you know, are you coming in hot off of whatever is upsetting you, or have you taken a breath, gotten some perspective maybe? I have a rule sometimes if I'm really upset about something, I write an email with no to in the list. Yeah. I just write it down and then I sleep on it. And almost always the next day, I don't want to send that, but I felt better. But don't put any to, don't address
it. Because it might go. And that would be a basic
You might
failure.
Send it off, yeah. But so kind of getting to the right place to have a conversation as opposed to vent.
I love that example. I also think the conflict, the training people on how do we do conflict here, I think is really important. I often find senior leaders are the most conflict averse sometimes because they've often gotten to where they are, you know, by being thoughtful and empathetic and that sort of thing. But we've actually had to introduce we had a longtime founder CEO who Karen knows. And when we transitioned to having a new CEO, part of what we had to do is new norms for our management team. And one of the things we did was how do we disagree with each other? And I think just even talking about that before the height of a conflict is super useful. And we had people who shared, this bothers me in a conflict or this stresses me out. I think just introducing that has prepared me for conflict a little bit more. Is that helpful to your question? Thank you for your thoughtful
question.
Katie, there was a hand over here before.
Would you mind coming up to the mic? Sorry, if you're able to. Thank you so much. Sorry, just so we can hear you.
Yep.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi. You can just hold it down.
Yeah, there you go.
But there you go. So my name's Kayla. I'm an undergraduate right now studying at UMass Boston. And Amy, I really connected to what you said about hating the phrase, don't come to me with problems, come to me with solutions. My question comes from the receiving end of that phrase, though, and this is mainly for Amy, but also for Karen and for Katie. What do you do when you receive that from someone above you as someone, per se, in an undergraduate role or in an early career role where you're hearing that again from the person who you report to, per se?
I think you say, I fully understand and appreciate why you might say that and the value of solutions. My concern is that I may encounter problems for which I alone can't develop a solution, so I may need the input of others, or there may be situations that I encounter that really will want other input before I try to solve them, especially as an undergraduate, et cetera. So it's just, it's just clarifying why that might be a concern so that we can do better.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
Great one. We'll get to one last question. Okay, hi.
Hi. I really appreciate this conversation. It was a lot more cerebral than I thought in terms of like analyzing failure. And I was wondering, so there are failures where, you want to face them and own up to them. And I'm wondering, how does compassion and emotion and feelings come into play in those situations?
Yeah, how does compassion on the person who is experiencing the failure, the leader?
Right.
Yes. How does compassion come into
play? I mean, this is a very emotional domain, right? So I forgive me if I implied it was all cognitive, all cerebral. In fact, I mean, in the very beginning, I talk about one of the reasons this is such a tough topic is because of the emotions that are just triggered. We are sort of instantly feelings of upsetness and fear and anxiety when we encounter evidence of our shortcomings, larger and smaller. So part of it is there's a whole chapter on how do we reframe, how do we sort of slow our thinking down so that we can challenge, and stop the awfulizing, right? So something goes wrong, you just, basically your thinking is, and then this, and then this, and then this, and then I'm going to die, right? That's actually, your brain actually does that. The amygdala hijack happens. So what the antidote is to kind of what I call stop, challenge, choose. Just pause, breathe. Challenge the, what Maxie Maltsby, the African-American psychiatrist who I profile in here, calls the believable but irrational thinking, right? Because you've got, your brain is believing it, and it's giving you all these bad emotions. Mm-hmm. Challenge it. Like, am I really going to die? No, actually, this is not fatal, this is inconvenient, right? More often than not. And so just learning the habit of step back, challenge that unhelpful thinking, and then choose a more thoughtful, helpful response for you to manage your own emotions.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
I want to say a huge thank you to Amy and Karen. I cannot recommend their books, The Right Kind of Wrong and The Microstress Effect, enough. I highly recommend it. I also just admire you both in the spirit of celebrating your colleagues' appreciation tradition. You're both women I deeply admire, and having met you, I admire you even more. So huge thanks for your books, your contributions, and for being here today. Amy and Karen are going to sign their books just to the left here. They're going to ask that you do signatures but no selfies, just so we get everyone out of here on time. And I want to thank everyone for coming out to celebrate great books, including Karen and Amy's today. It was so nice to spend some time with all of you. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great.
Thank you. That was great.